Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers, and it's episode 109. And today we're talking about search incident to arrest and three cases, one from the Virginia Court of Appeals and two from the Fourth Circuit, that are really interesting rulings on search incident to arrest. And I think two of the cases, I think, are going to surprise you a little bit about what the court's rulings are. And they reflect a growing restriction of law enforcement authority to search individuals and their grab space incident to arrest, and that had started a couple of years ago in this case called Davis. And in fact, the Fourth Circuit case we're going to talk about today specifically talks about that Davis ruling and sort of reaffirms it or breathes some more life into that ruling. And so we need to kind of talk about that today. But I want to start with the three cases. Two of them are from the Fourth Circuit, but one of them is from the Virginia Court of Appeals. And that case is a case called the Commonwealth versus Corcoran. And it's actually a Commonwealth's appeal. The Commonwealth suffered a motion to suppress at the trial court level, and the Commonwealth appealed to the Court of Appeals. So, and this is a case from Virginia Beach. One thing that I want to make sure everyone understands when we talk about these cases is usually when they go to a court of appeals, Fourth Circuit, Court of Appeals, Virginia Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, whatever, the government is usually the side that wins. It's rare for the Commonwealth to appeal. And so when the government wins, whatever side wins, when the case gets appealed, the court takes the facts in the light most favorable to the party that won below. And so because usually when cases go up on appeal, it's because the government won. If the government lost, usually the case is dismissed or it's lost, nothing else. You know, that's it. The case is over. So government usually doesn't get a right of appeal. But the government does get, in rare instances, a right of appeal. And one of those is motions to suppress. So sometimes the government will appeal in those cases. And when that happens, if the government's appealing the court granting a motion to suppress, the Court of Appeals is going to take the facts in the light most favorable to the defendant. And that's what's going to happen in this Corcoran case, which is a drug possession case from Virginia Beach. So what happens in this case is police respond to a domestic incident in a parking lot, and rescue workers also respond as well. The facts are a little bit confusing, and again, we have to take it in the light most favorable to the defendant. So the Commonwealth obviously had a version of this that the trial court didn't accept. But ultimately, what happens is Mr. Corcoran gets arrested after this domestic argument with his wife and children. He was in the parking lot. They get into an argument. They had been staying nearby in a hotel or a motel, but during the incident, he gets arrested. He gets taken to the ground. He gets hit with a taser. He gets in a fight. It's, you know, a fight with the police and so on. So at that point, he is, once he's in handcuffs and he's restrained, rescue comes, checks him out, and then he's taken to jail. And at that point, the defendant's wife, once he's gone, walks over to the officers and says, "Hey, look, he had the key to our room. We need to get back into the room." And so the officers say, "All right, well, where's his wallet? We've got his wallet somewhere." One of the officers says, "Oh yeah, here's the wallet. It's been, you know, it was seized from him." And the officer goes through the wallet, and while looking for the family's room key, the officer finds a baggie containing illegal drugs. And the defendant moves to suppress the evidence in that case. So we know that the defendant was arrested, and we know that, you know, as in any other police department, the policy here in Virginia Beach was after an arrest, any personal property that isn't contraband, like a wallet, is going to usually accompany the suspect to jail, right? And then they'll have an intake procedure, and, you know, personal property like a wallet and so on is going to be searched at the jail. But for some reason in this case, the wallet doesn't initially go with the defendant. It's still left back at the scene. The officer who opens the wallet and, while looking for the room key, finds these drugs, is able to testify, "Look, I know that this was taken from him sometime around the time of his arrest. I don't really know. I know it was found in his pants pocket. I don't know if I took it from his wallet or if somebody took it before his arrest or after his arrest or how long he'd been arrested when the wallet was seized. I just know that it was taken. And so the Commonwealth asks this question. The Commonwealth asks, and this is during the motion to suppress, did it become known to you that someone was asking to get something out of the defendant's wallet? Officer, correct. Commonwealth, can you describe to us what that was about? Officer, another officer made it known to me that the wife was asking for the condo key, and I was told to look for it inside the actual wallet itself. Commonwealth, okay, and do you know where the wallet had been found? Officer, in one of his pants pockets for the male that was in custody. And that's kind of the most detail that we get about where and when the wallet was found. So the trial court here says, and I'm quoting here from the trial court's ruling, I don't know where the wallet was when Officer Nash searched it. I don't know if it was still in his pocket, if it had been taken out, put in some kind of container. There's a lot of holes in this case, and I'm going to sustain the defendant's motion to suppress the search of the wallet. And so the Commonwealth appeals. And, you know, it makes sense the Commonwealth appeals because the rule is pretty clear that there's no bright line rule about how many minutes can need to pass between a search and an arrest for the arrest to be contemporaneous. We know that for a search incident to arrest to be lawful, it has to be contemporaneous, but that could be, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. In the Parity case, which is a case we talked about from last year, the court wrote, courts have found that a search may be incident to arrest where the search and the arrest were separated by times ranging from 5 to 60 minutes. That's quite a long time. I don't think that's a great idea to do it 60 minutes later, but the court, you know, said it's okay. But here again, the issue in this case was, while obviously the search took place after rescue left and after the defendant was taken away, there's no indicia in this case about when exactly it was that the search of the wallet took place. And so the court here in a footnote explicitly says, look, if the officers had searched the wallet immediately after his arrest, right, that would be lawful because it would be substantially contemporaneous with his arrest. The problem in this case is, the court says, the record provides no support for the conclusion that the wallet had actually been seized in a search at all, because the deputy says, I don't know who actually took the wallet, I just know that somebody went into his pants and took his pants pocket, took the wallet out. And so there's no clear testimony about when and how the wallet got taken out. And so because the court finds that there's meaningful gaps in the record, the court says, well, we can't apply the search incident to arrest doctrine because we don't know how and when the wallet was taken at all. We can't say that the officer's search was substantially contemporaneous with the arrest since the record failed to disclose any precise location in time between the arrest and the search. And, you know, of course, the Commonwealth's other argument in this case was, well, obviously the wallet would have been searched anyway because it was on the way to jail. Right, the wallet was on the way to jail, and when it got to the jail would have searched it. But here the court says it's unclear that such a process would have operated in that way because, again, it's not clear where the wallet would have been if the search hadn't occurred. We don't know how the wallet got found, where it was, you know, was it just on the ground? Was some officer taking it to the jail? Were they not taking it to jail? We don't know. It's ambiguous, right? The only testimony they had here was, you know, a question from the Commonwealth. Okay, and do you know where the wallet had been found? Officer says, in one of his pants pockets for the mail. So the court says, well, that testimony says it's clear that he was searched and the wallet was found, but we don't know who or how or when it was found or anything like that. That's the only testimony about the search that they had in this case. And because we cannot know where the wallet was when the officer searched it, we don't know, again, there's no inevitable discovery sort of argument that's going to work in this case. And finally, the court says we're going to apply the exclusionary rule in this case because, again, in this case, it's clear that an officer knows that, you know, your search has to be lawful under some exception to the warrant requirement. Search incident to arrest requires the search be contemporaneous, and here there's no evidence of that. So, again, the court sustains the motion to suppress. So you could look at this and say, you know, the Court of Appeals is being exceedingly academic about the officer's testimony. But remember, this is a Commonwealth's appeal. The trial court in this case granted the motion to suppress. So the Court of Appeals is going to look at this in the light most favorable to the defendant in this case. And, you know, certainly the panel here, it's Judges Causey, Cheney, and Callens. These are judges who oftentimes are found to dissent. They're certainly more favorable to defendants than some of the other Court of Appeals judges. So it's a tough panel to be in front of in any event. But again, it's in the light most favorable to the defendant. So the other two cases I want to talk about here today, I think, are really interesting as well. And the first one is a case called Commonwealth versus Horsley. It's from the same week as the Court of Appeals case. So the Court of Appeals case that we just talked about, the Corcoran case, that was on June 25th. The Horsley case is the day before, on June 24th. And this is a case where the defendant distributed and possessed with intent to distribute cocaine, methamphetamine, and heroin. The trial, they had evidence against him, including witness testimony from his co-conspirators, text messages extracted from cell phones, controlled buys, drugs, drug paraphernalia. But importantly, in this case, the officers in this case arrested the defendant at his hotel room. The officers have, you know, plenty of probable cause at this point. They go to the hotel room. He answers the door. He doesn't have any clothes on, and officers arrest him and put him in handcuffs while he's standing, cuffing him behind his back. Now, they've got him positioned on one side of a queen-sized bed in the hotel room. And on the other side of the queen-sized bed is a cell phone. It's about 2 or 3 feet from the edge of the bed. And so several U.S. Marshals were present in the room, and at a motion to suppress, an agent testified, and this is important, that the defendant couldn't have reached for the phones because he was under arrest, and he couldn't reach because he was in handcuffs. So officers seized the phone, and they later obtain a search warrant to search the phone. They also seize his car and so on. But here he moves to suppress, and the defendant argues the cell phone was not properly seized incident to his arrest because he had been physically secured by the officers at the time, and the cell phone was not under his immediate control. So the trial court denies the motion to suppress, and the defendant is convicted, and he appeals. And when it goes to the Fourth Circuit finds that the district court erred in its failure to suppress the evidence from the cell phone seized at the time of his arrest. The court here says that the district court erred in concluding that it was a search into arrest because at the time the defendant was secured and the cell phone was not within his reach. So here the court goes back to this case that we talked about a long time ago called Davis. Now, you might remember Davis. Davis is a case from South Carolina where the defendant is running away. He is, drug dealer. He's fleeing from the police in a vehicle, high-speed chase, police chase after him. He jumps out of the car. He's running, and he runs into a swamp. He's carrying a backpack, and he can't get any further, so he gives up. He comes back to the police. He drops the backpack on the ground. Several officers surround him. They get him to step away from the backpack, and then they get him to lay flat on the ground, and they get him in handcuffs. While he's laying on the ground in handcuffs, one officer steps away and goes to the backpack and searches it. And the argument is it's a search incident to arrest. But the Fourth Circuit says, no, that's not a lawful search incident to arrest because at the time he was secured and he wasn't within reaching distance of the backpack. And the court explains, police officers can conduct warrantless searches of non-vehicular containers incident to a lawful arrest only when the arrestee is unsecured and within reaching distance of the container at the time of the search. And the relevant question is whether it's reasonable for police to believe that a defendant could have accessed the item at the time of his search. So the court says, yeah, if the phone was in reach of the defendant, then the officers could have seized it, right? Because they can, you know, secure it with, it's got potential evidentiary value. You don't want him to, you know, reach out and touch it and delete it or lock it or whatever. But the court here says this is a lot like Davis because he's completely secured. He's separate from the phone. He couldn't possibly have gotten to it. And so there's no justification for seizing it incident to arrest. And in this case, if you're interested in it, there's actually a diagram. It's helpful to look at it. The diagram of the actual hotel room including where the defendant was standing and where the phone was found and so on. It can be kind of helpful to get a visual of what's going on here, right? But here we know the defendant doesn't have any clothes on. He's standing when he's arrested. He's got his hands cuffed behind his back. He's moved. He's positioned by the bed. The cell phone is on the table on the opposite side. The table is 2 to 3 feet from the edge of the bed. There's several marshals there. And again, the testimony of the officer is there's no way that the defendant could have reached the phone because he was under arrest. Sure, if he hadn't been under arrest, he could have gotten to it, but he was in handcuffs. And so, and then we have this chart here. So the court here says the defendant is secured, the phone wasn't within his immediate control, and therefore, because of that, it's not a lawful search incident to arrest. Again, applying this U.S. versus Davis case. Now, when we've talked about Davis before, we've talked about another case, which I think is really interesting, a case called U.S. versus Farabee, which had been decided a year before. And in Farabee, officers search another backpack incident to arrest. That backpack was inside of a house, and Farabee was being walked out of the house. He was in handcuffs as well. And so the government here asserts and makes the argument, hey, look, this is just like Farabee, right? He's standing up, he's ambulatory, he's in handcuffs. He could have broken free, gotten to the phone, just like in the Farabee case. And you thought the Farabee search was lawful. And the court here does something that's really, I think, interesting. The court basically goes back and rewrites its reasoning or its ruling in Farabee and says, no. In Farabee, the reason that we found that motion to suppress was improper, we found that the search was lawful in that case, was it wasn't because the officers were lawfully searching the backpack incident to arrest. The reason was that the Farabee claimed the backpack wasn't his, and so he disclaimed ownership of the property. And when you disclaim ownership of property, you can't claim a Fourth Amendment interest in that property. And so in that case, the court says, oh, yeah, well, in Farabee, we were just saying he didn't have standing to object to the search of the backpack. The other holding, which said that the search incident to arrest was lawful because he was, you know, he could have broken free and gotten to the backpack, they say, oh, that's dicta. And we didn't, you know, so it's not really binding, right? And in, you know, in the footnote, it's interesting that in this footnote, they write, in Davis, we distinguish Davis's case on the facts from Farabee's by noting that Farabee was standing up, whereas Davis was laying down. But then they don't really go any further into that. Like, yeah, that's the, you know, that's the difference. Isn't that the difference between it? And the court says, no, we didn't need to reach the issue of whether the search was lawful incident to arrest at all. And indeed, the court says the ruling in Farabee is at odds with the search incident to arrest rule. So if Farabee had the right to object to the backpack, the search of that backpack would have been unlawful in that case because it conflicts with you know, Chimmel and Gant and so on. So the court here says the other thing that's important that's different is that Farabee is a search of a backpack, which is a categorically different kind of search from a search from a cell phone. Because a backpack is an opaque container which can contain a weapon or contraband, but a phone is not. And so the court says, because the need to secure weapons and contraband are core justifications for searches incident to arrest, searching a backpack like the one in Farabee is more reasonable, all things being equal, than the search of a phone, which is on its face neither a weapon nor contraband. Now, in this case, it doesn't really end up mattering because the court says, look, it doesn't, I mean, in this case, there was so much evidence against the defendant that the search of the phone was really, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to change the outcome of the case. There was a ton of other evidence in this case that proved the defendant was guilty. And so the court says, you know, it was wrong to deny the motion to suppress, but his conviction is sustained. But I think in future, this case really doubles down on that Davis search incident to arrest rule. And by the way, if you're interested, it's episode 49 of the podcast. It was 3 years ago that we did this a podcast episode about Davis itself. So if you're interested in going back and listening to the episode about U.S. versus Davis, it's episode 49 of the podcast, which again, it's like about 3 years ago. All right, so two really big hits on search incident to arrest. Is there any good news on search incident to arrest? Yeah, there's an interesting case from this week from U.S. versus Green. This is a case from Maryland. It's a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals case. Again, it's a published opinion decided July 2nd. And in the Green case, this was a case where the defendant, who was a convicted felon, violently broke into a home while brandishing a firearm. A court issued a warrant for the defendant's arrest, and police sought the defendant, who had a prior robbery conviction, and ultimately located him after he went and got into another incident, where road rage incident, where he threatened somebody. So officers close in on him. They surround a residence where they'd located him. They even call in a helicopter for surveillance. And the police sergeant is the first person to see the defendant sitting outside the residence, and he's in the backyard with another man who ultimately turns out to be the resident. So the defendant wasn't living there. He was a frequent social guest, but the resident was out there, and they were in a gazebo. And the sergeant announced his presence and said, "Hey, stop, you're under arrest." The defendant stood up in this gazebo, and he had a handgun on him. He had a handgun in his shorts. And as the officer described it, he removed the handgun in a non-threatening manner. Of course, the officer yells out "gun" to the fellow officers. And the other officers start jumping the fence and going into the yard to apprehend the defendant. While the officers are closing in on him, the defendant takes this gun. Again, he's holding it in a non-threatening manner. He puts it on a shelf near this other guy, who, again, ultimately ends up being the resident in this gazebo, and then starts to back away towards the rear of the yard, trying to basically get away. But at this point, multiple officers are in the yard. They're in the front. They're in the rear. They get him against the back fence. And ultimately, about 25 feet away from the gun, they get him into custody. So about 15 seconds later, this is all happening pretty fast. 15 seconds later, the sergeant jumps over the fence. Now, his team members are apprehending and handcuffing the defendant. At this point, the sergeant says, "All right, there's enough officers at the back fence to control the defendant, but they're still trying to apprehend him, and they're still in the process of getting him in custody." And at this point, the companion, this other guy who turns out to be the resident, is sitting at this gazebo next to this gun. And so the sergeant says, "All right, once it looks like they've got the defendant under control, his priority was, I'm going to secure that gun, which is sitting next to the shelf next to this person, so it can't be used against the officers who are effectuating the arrest." So the officer goes over and just stands next to the gun. And then about 10 minutes later, people come over and they photograph it, and then they seize the firearm. The defendant moves to suppress, and the court said and argues it's not a lawful search incident to arrest. Now, there's a whole side argument here about, does the defendant have standing to object to this search? And ultimately, the court says, yeah, he does, as a frequent social visitor at this house. That's kind of a conversation for another day. We'll talk about that another time. I'm interested in the search incident to arrest issue. So the court here, the trial court, says he doesn't have standing and denies the motion to suppress. The Fourth Circuit looks at it and says, no, he does have standing. He has a Fourth Amendment right of privacy here. But the officers didn't violate the Fourth Amendment when they entered the yard and seized the gun. Now, I think this is interesting because, again, if you compare it, it's officers entering into a residence, right? In the previous one, it was a hotel room. But remember, a hotel is someone's home during the time that they're staying there. And so that's considered to be your home. This is the curtilage. This is the backyard, which is also your home. So a hotel room, curtilage, these are all the home under the Fourth Amendment. And so generally speaking, the only three ways into a home are consent, a warrant of some kind, or exigent circumstances. And in these cases, the officers have a warrant to arrest both of these defendants. They have a warrant to arrest the last defendant, a warrant to arrest this defendant. But in the last case, they go in, right? Then in the Green case, the case with the cell phone, they go in and they're, securing him. And there's his phone, and the phone is, he has to get over the bed to get to it, but it's a long way. Here the case from last week was Horsley. This case is Green. So in this case, the officers have, piled onto Green, and they're still securing him, but they got him under control. It seems like it would be very similar, right? So why does it turn out differently than Horsley? Well, in this case, the court says The officers lawfully enter the yard pursuant to an arrest warrant, so they're lawfully in this property. And then the court says the sergeant obviously initially saw the firearm from a public street outside the yard where the officer had a lawful right to stand. And at that point, the defendant conceded, obviously, that once that point he's on the property, the arrest warrant allows them to enter. And the officers at this point, when they enter, know that the defendant has a prior felony conviction. And that point is what's crucial here. Because remember, the officers see somebody who they know is a convicted felon and he has a firearm. So at that point, it's immediately apparent that his possession of the firearm is unlawful. And so here the court says, look, we can debate all day long about, you know, when the arrest takes place. Does it take place, you know, at the moment that the handcuffs click shut or when they've got him secured or whatever? But the point is, the arrest warrant for the defendant authorized the police to intrude into the residence to effectuate the arrest. And so at that point, like the entry of the other fellow officers who run in to tackle the defendant, the sergeant's own entry isn't a violation of the Fourth Amendment. He's got a lawful right to go into this house. And so once you are lawfully in the yard, you can seize any evidence that's in plain view. So now, instead of relying on the search incident to arrest exception, we're relying on the plain view exception to the search warrant requirement. And so here the court says that the seizure of this phone is lawful, is authorized not by a search incident to arrest, but instead authorized by plain view. Now, that takes us back to that Horsley case from last week, because remember, the officers are entering into the apartment, into the motel room, they're arresting the defendant, and there's his phone sitting on the table. So is there another argument to make besides search incident to arrest for the seizure of that phone, right? You couldn't make an inventory search argument unless you were somehow able to articulate that the phone was the defendant's property, right? If you tried to make the inventory search argument, I think then you'd be back in that Corcoran case, right? Are we seizing it simultaneous with his arrest as part of a routine procedure? You might be able to articulate that. But I'm going to turn you to another Davis case, and this was the U.S. versus Davis case from January 25th from the Fourth Circuit. And if you listen to episode 101, which was an episode about 5 months ago, we talked about the Davis case and also another case from the Virginia Court of Appeals called Commonwealth versus Hudson that talked about when it is that a phone is, when you have probable cause to seize a phone in plain view as potential evidence of a crime. And in U.S. versus Davis, that was a case where officers are executing a search warrant for some totally unrelated reason, gun case. They see the defendant. He's got a large quantity of drugs. He tries to hide them. He is apparently a drug dealer. And then they see his phone, and they seize his phone in plain view. And the court in that case says the phone's incriminating character was immediately apparent given the substantial quantities of controlled substances that were found on the defendant's person and in his bedroom packaged for distribution. And again, you know, they talked about the connection between drug trafficking and the use of cell phones. Cell phones aren't always able to be seized in plain view as instrumentalities of crime. You need to have probable cause, right? But you can, if you sufficiently articulate probable cause, seize a phone in plain view. And in Kummel versus Hudson, which was a case from July 18th of 2023 from the Court of Appeals, that was a case from Richmond, again, where police seized a phone in plain view. And again, in that case, the court said under the totality of the circumstances, in the car there was guns, marijuana, lots of phones, unclaimed phones, and so on. A phone's incriminating character can be immediately apparent and seized for that reason. So, unfortunate rulings for the Commonwealth in two of those cases, Commonwealth versus Corcoran and Commonwealth and U.S. versus Horsley. But in U.S. versus Green, I think we see a potential, if this case happens again, another way to look at it, another way to argue it in court. So I hope today was helpful. I hope it was interesting. We're going to keep doing the podcast as long as you guys find it to be interesting. We keep an eye on cases. We got some interesting U.S. Supreme Court rulings this last month and so on. So lots to talk about this summer. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell your friends. But other than that, for today, that's all from me. That's all from Big E. Stay safe and don't get captured.